for help. Taking the stairs two at a time, Henderson reached the next floor of the building and hid in a closet to drop his pants and extract the bamboo tube of jolt from its hiding place. Taking a deep sniff up each nostril, the man instantly felt years younger, stronger, smarter, his heart pounding with renewed strength inside his old chest. As he buckled his belt, he could hear the constant explosion of live rounds from upstairs, and an alarm bell was ringing. He wondered how anybody could have learned of his escape so quickly. Going down the hallway and through the kitchen, he passed the cringing servants and reached the banquet hall, heading straight for the damaged window. It was his only chance of escape. The first floor of the building was the barracks for the SEC men. He'd never get out that way. Grabbing a chair, the white hair battered at the weakened planks until they came free and fell to the floor.
Hey!
A woman shuffled forward with a strange expression on her face. Ruthlessly, Henderson fired point blank, the .44 caliber round opening up the belly of the serving girl like a bag of rope. Returning to his work, the old baron tore fingernails as he struggled to remove the last of the planks and kick his way through the glass. More planks covered the window from the outside, but those were easy to remove, and soon Henderson was able to climb onto the ledge. He was bleeding from both hands, but the river was almost directly below. As he tested the wind and tried to gauge the distance, the old baron felt itchy all over, the tingling sensation oddly pleasant, mixed with the effects of the jolt. And then he went stone blind. Startled, he slipped off the ledge and fell, going into a dive as he tried to angle for the river. Baron John Henderson slammed head first onto the cracked pavement of Green Coveville, missing the rushing waters of the cool river by less than a yard. Death was instantaneous. He was one of the lucky ones. With all of his might, Seaton threw the spear across the fiery war room and hit the last keg of black powder, cracking it apart a split second before the raging fire got through the wood. Instantly, the black powder flared brighter than the sun, producing volumes of acrid smoke, but the deadly explosion was avoided. Duquesne headed for the doorway and held the map table as a shield.
Follow me!
With slugs slapping into the tabletop, the Baron backed out of the war room, herding the rest of the SEC men to safety. Reaching the next room, Seaton slammed the dividing door shut and threw the bolt, sealing the fire on the other side. The SEC men sighed in relief, then started to rub vigorously at their faces.
I want Henderson found and skinned alive!
Baron Duquesne railed furiously, casting the table aside. He waited for the expected response, but the others were too busy scratching themselves. Suddenly crying out, the men began to tear at their faces, weeping and waving their hands as if the very air were attacking them. They started to bump into one another and to twitch uncontrollably, shouting obscenities and clawing bloody gouges in their skin. Rubbing at his slightly itchy forearms, Duquesne could only stare in bafflement at the convulsing people. His men were acting as if they had gone blind. Watching in horrid fascination, the Baron slowly came to comprehend that the analogy was correct. They were blind, but how? Something in the smoke? Had Henderson poisoned the food? If so, then why wasn't he affected? This was when Duquesne noticed the antique steel army helmet on his head was becoming uncomfortably hot. He started to remove it before realizing the metal had to be somehow protecting him from whatever was happening. There were more helmets in the war room, but the flames were licking at the ceiling, bullets discharging constantly. Return was impossible. Accepting that, Duquesne picked up the battered table and plowed a path through the screaming people to reach the door to the stairs, only to find a snarling Seaton clawing at the locked door, trying to dig his way through. Without a qualm, the Baron shot the man and left him dying on the floor to be trampled by the others while he slipped through and locked the door behind him. There was no sense allowing the others to get in the way of his escape. Blind, they were dead already as far as he was concerned. Heading quickly down the stairs, Duquesne heard the alarm bell ringing over the blaster fire from above. What the hell was going on in Hisville? Was this some sort of an attack? Maybe Nathan Carter heard of his intent to attack Front Royal and was melting Green Cove first. Damn the man. Not even an offer to surrender first. The man would pay for that with his life. On the ground floor, he found only chaos in the barracks, the sect men stabbing and shooting one another for no sane reason. It was literally a blind panic. Faintly, from the dungeon below, Duquesne could hear the prisoners begging for help, and he dismissed them all without a thought. If he couldn't help his sect men, why should he care about thieves and murderers? The smell of his singeing hair was beginning to choke the man, the antique army helmet becoming almost too hot to touch. But Duquesne accepted the pain and watched the armed mob chilling one another as the men fought to escape through wide-open doorways. Covered in blood, one man simply clawed at his face until the flesh was in tatters, endlessly yelling that this was all a dream and couldn't be happening. Duquesne leveled his blaster at the beleaguered soul, then decided it was stupid to waste a round on a walking corpse. The Baron itched horribly on his arms and legs, but through sheer force of will kept his hands from tearing at the flesh. This wasn't what Henderson had described. The stone walls were cool to the touch, and there was a smell of smoke, but not fire in the air. Front Royal was doing something new. However, if this was a sky attack, then he'd better get as far away from the open air as possible. For a split second, he debated trying for the river, then changed his mind and headed for the stairs that led to the dungeon. Deep underground, he should be safe from the sky machine. And when the attack stopped, he would take all of the supplies he could pack into a wag and leave the rest of his people to await the arrival of the enemy troops. The survivors would probably be taken into chains as slaves, but not him. That wasn't how Armand Duquesne would exit the world. Reaching the basement of the Predark building, Duquesne felt the terrible itching noticeably lessen and sighed with relief. Then he heard the telltale click-clack of cell doors opening and saw the ragged prisoners walking out of their cells, carrying the blasters and keys of the prison guards. Snarling, Duquesne swung his blaster around and fired, chilling half a dozen before the rest swarmed over him, yanking away the blaster and knocking off the steel helmet. Duquesne braced himself for the onslaught of blindness and was shocked when it didn't occur. The walls had to be too thick down here. He was protected from the ravages of the sky machine, but then he realized it also meant that the prisoners were unaffected. They could see. The men and women he had been brutally torturing for months, years, were loose and armed and could see. His pitiful wails for mercy were swamped by the gleeful howls of the starving prisoners as they savagely ripped away his clothing and began to tear the hated Baron apart with their bare hands. Duquesne's ghastly screams of agony rose in pitch as the starving men and women began to gorge themselves on raggedy gobbets of his tender flesh. In the bottom level of the redoubt, the companions checked their equipment one last time.
Ready?
Ryan shifted the weight of the heavy pack on his back. The fluted plastic tubes of a couple of Law rocket launchers jutted from the pack, along with a single Hafla. The attack was going to be a night creep, a silent penetration, but in case of trouble, Ryan wanted some big ordnance to help blast their way to freedom. As the trader always said, a man could never have too many friends or too much explosives.
Ready as we're going to be.
JB felt more like himself again with the S&W shotgun and an AK-47 strapped across his back. The Uzi hung at his right side, and a bulging bag of explosives serving as a counterbalance on the left side of his body. In preparation for the assault, the companions had enjoyed a good meal and gotten a few hours of sleep during the day. Fed and rested, every companion carried a Kalashnikov, a bulging ammo pouch either on their belt or slung over his shoulder. Jack also toted the remaining crossbow with an arrow notched under the string and two more taped to either side of the stock for fast loading. These were the last three of the homemade arrows, and only two had steel arrowheads. But the weapon was silent, and in the teenager's deft hands would chill from a very great distance. Only Dean wasn't burdened with plast charges. He had hauled down a chair from one of the offices upstairs and was piling boxes and bags in front of it to make a crude barricade. Rotating the cylinder of his Lama to visually inspect the charged chambers, Doc set the selector pin and slid the mammoth hand cannon into its holster.
You know, sometimes I am sorry about throwing my hat into the Hudson River. A hat makes a man feel more protected, fully clothed.
Mildred stuffed more rags into a duffel bag sitting on the floor.
It was a damn silly thing. Made you look a little like Lincoln.
A wise and great man.
who got shot in the back of the head.
Bad luck.
Man makes his own luck.
Dean sounded exactly like his father. Ryan nodded. Amazing good luck hadn't gotten him the 7.62 millimeter rounds now loaded into his Steyr SSG-70.